Hey everyone, I'm your host Tom Shaughnessy and welcome back to Chain Reaction, a research-driven podcast that's a part of Delphi Digital. If you're not on Delphi's research portal, you're missing out on the critical analysis read by the top minds in the crypto space, so be sure to check it out. One quick housekeeping item, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. I may personally hold tokens mentioned on the podcast, and you can view our show notes below for our complete disclosures. With that, let's jump into the episode.
Thanks very much for joining me today, Glenn.
Oh, my pleasure to be here, Jose.
So having studied economics at university, I was very much kind of indoctrinated into certain ideas about economics. Capitalism is about private property, freedom, and competition, which is the opposite of central planning, which restricts freedom and is inefficient. Capitalism, we were taught, had kind of won, and the assumption was that the system we had arrived at was basically worked as well as possible. And the only exceptions were really these weird cases of market failure, which could be fixed via just moderate regulation, and government just needed to kind of step out of the way. And that's what made your book such a kind of breath of fresh air for me, was the originality and imagination in some of the solutions. And one of the things you point out that I found really interesting is that the spirit of imagination that spawned the very ideas that now make up sort of the economic dogma is the same spirit that's needed now to kind of move past the current paradigm. So in this conversation, I'd like to explore some of those ideas and try and open our listeners' minds to some of the possibilities there.
I couldn't have asked for a better opening, so thank you.
Cheers. And so just to start with, I guess, the status quo, reminiscent of kind of Peter Thiel, you talk about the decline in productivity combined with the inequality, or what you refer to as kind of stagnant quality, with us being one of the first generations that's worse off than their parents. I guess, what factors do you think contribute to this?
I think it's really the failure of our social technology to keep up with our physical advances. Albert Einstein once said that if we had built institutions, ways of organizing ourselves that were as advanced as the tools we have available to us, we'd all have carefree and happy lives. But that as it is, we've put razor blades in the hands of three-year-old children. And I think that, to me, that's the essence of what's gone so wrong. If you look at the fundamental advances, you know, Industrial Revolution, whatever, they were not really about technology per se. They were fundamentally about the way in which those technologies got socially organized. You know, the fundamentals of, you know, steam engines and whatever were available in the early, 19th century. But what really led productivity to take off was the way that those got organized into factories, mass production, et cetera, which really didn't happen until the very late 19th, early 20th century. Electricity was all about the grids, not about lightning hitting Benjamin Franklin's key, right? And the problem is that we've forgotten the need for us to advance in those forms of social organization rather than just, our technical skills. We've come to take for granted that we've achieved sort of the best possible form of social organization. And I think that's what's leading us to fall behind.
That's really interesting. So it's kind of a social technology lagging behind traditional or physical technology. And you also talk a lot about kind of inequality as a problem with Western society. Now, a lot of kind of neoclassical or traditional economists argue inequality is more like a feature than a bug, you know, and as long as the poorest are better off in absolute terms, that it doesn't really matter. And it's kind of just a consequence of this globalized world where there's increasing returns to scale for talent. And I guess what would be your response to that? And why do you think inequality is a bigger problem than they give it credit for?
Well, I love what you said about increasing returns to scale, because to me, that's actually at the root of all of this. The fundamental nature of, you know, social organization is that there are increasing returns, that there are these social effects where we're able to do more together, where, you know, one person can reach a big audience, et cetera, or there's a need to focus on certain places. That's the origin of the city. That's the origin of networks. And I think the fundamental paradox there is that markets, just according to the theory, don't work in those circumstances. Markets, you know, in the typical classical sense, are made for declining returns activities. And this may sound a little technical, but I want to belabor it because I think it's really critical. If you run a factory and you want to pay people their marginal product, which economic theory says that you should, you can only make a profit if you have a decreasing returns technology. Because in that case, the marginal amount that a worker produces is going to be less than they produce on average, which is going to mean that if you pay them that marginal product, you'll make a profit. On the other hand, if you have an increasing returns activity, then if you pay everyone their marginal product, you'll make a loss. So it is in the nature of anything with increasing returns to not be consistent with efficient capitalist production. And so to me, the fundamental problem of inequality is not that it's inherently bad. I don't want to focus on that, but rather that it's an indication that the market system is malfunctioning and that we need something better.
That's a really interesting perspective. Yeah, I'd never thought about it that way. And so I guess it's a case of the increasing returns to scale mean that, you know, wages haven't scaled with those. They've sort of stayed at the average wage level, and so companies can make a lot more profit, but the workers' wages haven't scaled alongside that.
Exactly. And that as a result of that, we're not getting efficiency. I don't want to emphasize here the inherent inequality, but rather than inequality, precisely by the logic that you said, Jose, is indicative of an increasing return situation that's being treated like a decreasing return situation, and that therefore is being treated inefficiently.
And in this scenario, I guess the inefficiency is the shareholder profits, right? That's where the inefficiency kind of shows up.
Exactly.
That's really cool. And I mean, you mentioned this a lot in terms of that in your book, that property is monopoly, right? That kind of a related point, that normally monopoly is when someone owns all of a good and can charge higher prices by limiting supply. But because kind of goods are a lot more unique than sort of economic theory gives them credit for, you know, like a worker is a lot more unique, a programmer, a house, intellectual property, they're all a lot more unique, that actually, you know, everyone has a lot more bargaining power over their capital than sort of economic theory gives it credit for. And so there's a lot more monopoly power there. Could you expand on that a bit and kind of talk about the consequences to society?
Even more fundamental and even stronger case than that, because I think it's really important. I think that the problem of monopoly is inherent and unavoidable if you want to have any form of advanced civilization. Why is that? The only time you avoid monopolies is when you have nothing with increasing returns, right? We know that there are natural monopolies when you have increasing returns, right? Anytime that you have, that we're all going to achieve more together than we could separately and individually, you're going to end up with a problem of natural monopoly. But increasing returns are responsible for the fact that we don't live in isolated huts separate from each other. So if you want to have civilization, you've got to have increasing returns. And if you have increasing returns, you're going to end up with natural monopoly, period. So I think that, you know, for that reason, there's just a fundamental contradiction between the successes that capitalism claims, the Industrial Revolution, electricity, the computer revolution, et cetera, which are all increasing returns phenomena at their core, and the rhetoric that capitalism uses to justify capitalism's responsibility for it, which is all about decreasing returns and you know, competitive markets and so forth.
That's really interesting. And I guess that would explain why sort of inequality has kept increasing and why returns on capital have kept sort of outpacing growth in wages and all of that, is that we're living in an increasingly increasing returns to scale world, and sort of our institutions haven't adjusted to that.
Exactly.
Okay, that's super interesting. I mean, could you talk a bit about your solutions to some of these problems? I mean, the obviously in your book, you talk about property being monopoly, and you talk about a bunch of different solutions to it, from some of the ones that were came up with by earlier economists, like competitive common ownership, Vickrey Commons, Roger Meyerson's work on that, and then also your own like cost solution. Maybe take whatever you want of that. So
let me rather than go into very specific things first, mm-hmm. talk about what I think is the general philosophy, which is that I think we need to bring markets to the core of democracy, and we need to bring democracy to the core of markets. What do I mean by those things? So first of all, as I just pointed out, markets fundamentally cannot work in increasing returns environments based purely on private property, because increasing returns phenomena inherently have this problem that you need to pay out more than they can take in a competitive market. How do you make up for that? Well, you need to, that money, that value that they're paying out is genuine value created. It's not just disappearing. It's not just, just because the thing can't fund itself in a standard market doesn't mean that value is gone. There's a sort of conservation of energy. So that value goes somewhere. It goes out into decreasing returns activities, congested roads created by that city, people needing housing and housing being scarce in that city, somebody controlling some choke point somewhere and making a bunch of profit off of that. So that's the way that things go. There's a conservation of energy, conservation of value, and all those increasing returns things are throwing off that value. It's being absorbed somewhere. So fundamentally, you have to extract the value from there somehow. You need to tax those things. And that has to be sort of controlled by and funneled towards those increasing returns activities, which are not going to run on a completely standard principle. They have to run on a democratic principle that allocates it to those really valuable activities, right? So you have to bring democracy to the core of how markets operate. You have to democratize those organizations that organize that increasing returns activity, and they need to be funded by these more democratic principles. On the other hand, the standard way that democracy works is completely inconsistent with making that happen. Why is that? Democracies, as they're standardly done, are based on some geographic area with some fixed set of people in it. And everything that we're talking about are these incredibly dynamic, ever-shifting things that democracy can't keep up with. So there's a fundamental tension here that we need to use the market mechanism in how those democracies work. And those are the real principles that lie behind the mechanisms that you were referring to.
Yeah, and this is kind of what I really loved about this book. It's that some of your solutions, when I first read them, I was like, that sounds kind of Marxist to me. But then other solutions, I was like, that sounds kind of like uber capitalist libertarian to me. And it's kind of you've picked out sort of first principles of both and created something that seems quite new. It's quite interesting. I mean, would you be able to, I guess, work through an example of how this would work in practice? Maybe your cost solution or one of those, or what you would be taxing, and just so people understand it sort of on a lower level.
Let's start with the example of how do we make democracy with more of a market principle actually more relevant to the dynamic and ever-shifting world that we have. But at the same time, how do we democratize markets? And I think that there's one that's a perfect example of that, which is the idea of quadratic finance. This is an idea that I came up with Zoe Hitzig, who's a Harvard PhD student and a poet and a brilliant person, and Vitalik Buterin, who's the founder of Ethereum blockchain. And the idea is to fund organizations through a combination of sort of tax or philanthropy finance and individual contributions according to a matching formula, where the individual contributions get matched by the philanthropic or government funds, but not like one for one or two for one or whatever. Instead, they're matched so that the amount of matching is decreasing in the size of the contribution and increasing in the number of the individual contributors. So sort of democratic goods that many different people all support get more funding than plutocratic goods that only a very small number of people support.
That's cool. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And what do you say to people that think that sort of private property and kind of even land ownership is seen as a core part of capitalism and also a core part of the American dream? You know, the idea of sort of if you work by, you know, by your own sweat, you can eventually get your own plot of land and your own house and all of this. And the idea that kind of taxing that in the way that you kind of describe in the book is somehow infringing on that capitalist ideal.
Well, I think that it's that version of the American dream myth has always been in tension with a reality that so many people are renters, and that American, you know, freedom has always run up against the cities, right? So, you know, that was always a vision of the West, you know, and in fact, there was always a notion of going west to find your land. But to the extent we want to prosper from cities, and it's an increasingly urban country, we need to understand that land is going to be scarce and that there are going to be different competing uses for that land. And that if all the value just goes to whoever happens to have first settled it, that actually interferes with others' ability to do the same in the future in those places.
Yeah, that makes sense. So there's kind of a conflict between the freedom bit and the private property bit, right? I mean, you know, if you declare individual land ownership, then it means you thwart the competition that would result in the best use being made of that land. And I guess you think that competition should win because it brings the most utility to society, which makes sense and which is what capitalism, I guess, was designed to do.
Well, I don't think it's, so competition is one way of putting it, but it's also the ability to cooperate and to cooperatively choose the things that we're going to be doing together, which is impeded by one person having an exclusive claim over some, you know, area of stuff whose value is actually created by the interaction between lots of different people.
That's interesting. And I mean, another cool thing I learned about with your book was that a lot of the fathers of the marginal revolution, I think Jevons and some of the others were actually in favor of this, and they thought that private property was monopoly too, which is kind of an idea that would be totally shocking to me that kind of the fathers of Austrian economics would think such a thing. But you know, that they came up with these ideas as well, and I think Henry George as well had his common ownership idea, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and you know, Leon Walras, I think, is one of the greatest examples of this. He was really the founder of a lot of modern economics, and he very much believed, despite he being associated with this perfect notion of a market, that was only possible in a regime where most private property was abolished.
That's really interesting. And why do you think these ideas, I guess, feel so weird when you first hear them, or so kind of shocking? You know, when you think about kind of someone being able to buy your house from you at the price that you set, while the utility of it all makes sense, it feels kind of harsh and shocking. It feels like I should have my house and you know, it's some right that I inherently have. I'm not sure why, but perhaps it's the indoctrination of kind of, you know, of a few years of economics. But why do you think they feel so weird?
Well, I don't even know that it's the indoctrination of years of economics. I'd actually say in some ways it's the reverse. If you think about it, when you usually hear debates around markets, usually the debate is between people who like favor markets and accept that they'll disrupt people's lives in various ways, or people who are skeptical of markets because they'll, you know, cause those sorts of disruptions. And I actually think that what I'm describing is just more in that direction, right? And so it's actually just more consistent with the principle of markets than is the standard rhetoric.
Yeah, that makes sense actually. And in terms of, I guess, governance, because you touched on that before, you mentioned that obviously while some markets, the problem is there's kind of too much market power. Another problem which you mentioned is that in some areas of human life, there's not enough markets, right? We need to bring markets to democracy, as you said, like public goods, like policing, public parks, roads. And again, it's another situation where most people would think a market for something like this, for like political influence, is preposterous. You know, it would end in plutocracy and us being dominated by the rich. But obviously, there's problems with the alternative as well, right? With every person having the same say, because, you know, the rule of the mob problems, and because they can't kind of express their conviction. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that we've come to have a very, 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 very rigid understanding of what democracy is, that's based around a physically situated nation state as sort of the only way that you can have any notion of, you know, democracy. And then it has to be, you know, one person, one vote. But if you think about it, most democracies that have existed, you know, in the history of the world, were based around a whole range of different things, from churches that democratize themselves to organizations that have members that run democratically. And if we're going to have flexible, emergent, different forms of democracy, the only way to do that is to move beyond, here are the boundaries, and everyone's either one or zero, in or out. There has to be some way that we can be more open than that. And in fact, on almost every relevant issue, the nation state doesn't line up with the people that are relevant for that issue. Just to take two examples, think about drug policy. This is an area that overwhelmingly disproportionately affects Black and brown people. And yet the majority of Americans for whom it's not a critical issue get just as much of a vote as everybody else does on this issue, right? On the other hand, and the Latin Americans, who it has such a huge effect on, get no vote on this issue. Another example is rivers. So rivers go through a small part of many different countries. Think about the Amazon River, which cuts through, I don't know, half a dozen countries in South America. Each of these countries, there's a set of people who live along the river who are disproportionately affected by it, and all of the countries are affected by it. And rather than, you know, one country like Brazil being able to just bully around the other countries and even bully the minority of its population that depends on that river, there have to be new ways for us to respond more effectively to that. Quadratic voting, which is related to the quadratic finance I talked before, I think is one particularly appealing direction to go in. And there are additional refinements on it. But we first have to break past this notion that we've sort of arrived at the true form of democracy, because our forms of democracy are obviously completely ill-suited to deal with most of the challenges that we're confronting today.
Absolutely. I mean, could you just briefly describe quadratic voting for people who aren't aware of it?
Yeah. So quadratic voting is a tool very similar to quadratic finance, where you can have a pool of votes that you can allocate to things, and you can put more votes on the things that are most important to you. But the more votes you put on something, the less weight they carry per vote. So you get the most influence if you spread out your votes among many different things, and less if you concentrate it on a small number of issues. So it allows a minority to win out on an issue, but only when that issue is really much more important to that minority than it is to the rest of the population.
That's really cool. So it basically enables conviction, right? To express conviction with your votes, or like magnitude of conviction.
Expensive and costly to do so. So, you know, if you think about it, like the two problems our society faces are both, you can get a tyranny of a majority, but at the same time, you can get a small, you know, group of sort of trolls out there costlessly screaming about something. And so what you really need to do is get the balance between those two things right, so that people, you know, have sort of a rationed amount of screaming that they're allowed to do, but they can scream about the things that are most important to them. And that's exactly what quadratic voting enables.
That's very cool. And I guess what you're doing there as well is transforming voting into you're giving it market mechanisms, right? In terms of scarcity. And I guess in radical markets. I sort of, you gave the most lucid description of markets that I'd ever heard in terms of why it won over central planning, I suppose, in helping people, in allowing people to reveal their private information. I wonder if you could just recount that to our listeners, just because I think a lot of people would benefit from it.
Well, in my view, and let me like update it to the present.
Definitely.
To me, the key thing is, think about AI. People talk a lot today about and to me, AI is just a modern version of central planning. People keep talking about, we're going to have this computer and it's going to, pass the Turing test and it's going to be much better than, people or whatever. There are 9 billion people out there on the planet. There is, just from a pure, no sentimentality or whatever perspective, you're incredibly dumb in terms of economic planning to say, oh, well, yeah, there's all these people, but yeah, let's just start again. It's a waste trying to deal with any of them. Let's just make some artificial intelligence. That's just such an incredibly stupid way to use those resources. The most intelligent people don't just try to compete with each other. They try to complement each other's skills because that's when they can take advantage of having so many other people out there. And in the same way, the most effective technology are the ones that actually harness the availability of all those human skills out there, and the fact that they're all over the planet, that they're exposed to all sorts of different cultures, and they have all sorts of different information. The most effective technology and the most effective social systems are the ones that harness the capacities of as many people as possible, rather than trying to replace them with something that's neater and tidier, but actually wastes most of those resources that are available. And that was the problem with central planning, communism. That is the problem with the AI approach to technology today.
Okay. And do you think, I think you discussed this at the end, but do you think it's possible that kind of an AI that has a sufficient amount of data and a sufficient amount of computing power can recreate the effect of markets, the effect of sort of the 9 billion people each expressing their own private preferences via, these market interactions, or you think markets are likely to remain superior?
Well, I think that the whole approach of competing with existing systems rather than trying to complement them is a really, really dumb approach. It's sort of like saying, we have available all this air out there. Why don't we just go and recreate some sort of synthetic oxygen just to show that we can do it, rather than like, how do we take advantage of the availability of air in order to have plants that breathe the air, have humans that breathe the air, fly through the air. Like, there are all these people out there. There's all these people with all this diverse information. Why not harness them and make them part of something greater rather than talking about competing with all the things that they already do well?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think corporations are to an extent sort of centrally planned, right? And I'm curious why you think the sort of system of corporations ended up beating out the system of central planning, given that a lot of, especially nowadays, a lot of industries are dominated by a small number of very, very large and centrally planned organizations. And do you think there are like flaws with that are being revealed or that will come out soon?
I think the reason why corporations run over like some nation state based central planning, and it's really important to understand that central planning was never like truly central planning. That would be some global scale thing. It was nation state based planning.
Yeah.
And so these are just two different forms of planning. The one fundamental problem with a lot of economics is that there's like the center, the state, and the individual. And all of the richness in between is lost. And that's where everything interesting happens. I think ultimately the strength of corporations was that they were flexible, entrepreneurial, adaptive, and not completely rigid and fixed based on the past. So ultimately, it was the corporations won over the sort of physically delineated nation state form. They didn't really win over central planning because, as you mentioned, there's a lot of central planning within corporations. And what we need to allow for is more of that diverse emergent forms of organization that allow for increasing returns in a way that standard market logics don't, but then on the other hand, aren't based on some completely rigid and fixed structure.
Yeah. And I think a lot of your ideas for governance accomplish this. One of the things I found super interesting as well was the kind of brief history you give of governance and of different systems that have existed, because we tend to think that this everyone has a vote has always been there. But actually, there have been, you know, multiple different systems. I mean, one of the ones you talk about is mixed constitution. And then obviously there were different systems in the UK and the US. Yeah, I mean, why do you think, maybe if you want to talk a bit about those, and also why you think we ended up zeroing in on this system as sort of the universal that everyone considers best?
Arrogance. I think that things went pretty well after World War II for, you know, the broad Western liberal democracies, which had completely at that point transformed themselves. And it was precisely that innovation that they had, you know, succeeded on. And I mean, really, it is the standard story of disruptive innovation from entrepreneurship, right? There was a, you know, old, successful company that just thought it could plod along making incremental changes and that nothing would come along to disrupt it. And that is how you sink into stagnation, eventually internal division and being superseded by alternatives. That's exactly, I think, what happened to the Western world, and Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History, was the classic example of that sort of arrogance manifesting itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you see these ideas? I guess how do you see, because obviously in the market, entrepreneurs can compete, start companies, and express sort of their divergent views through that. How do you see these kind of more economic, political, social ideas being tested and implemented? I mean, do you see crypto as a way to do that? Or do you have any other ideas of how these ideas will end up proliferating?
Well, I think any valuable idea is useful in the small if it's useful in the large. These ideas are being used in video games. The latest version of the strategy game, the best-selling strategy game of all time, Civilization, uses a bunch of these ideas and people interact with them in the dynamics of how these civilizations are set up. They are used in governments, local governments, because people are really frustrated with our lack of progress. So lots of governments are open-minded. The government of Taiwan and the government of Estonia are incredible leaders on a lot of these things. And we're also the most successful countries in confronting the COVID epidemic. So those are phenomenal examples for us to follow.
And have you seen any interesting sort of implementations in that? Because I know you work quite closely with, or have worked quite closely with Vitalik. Any interesting implementations of governance in the crypto asset space? I mean, obviously, Ethereum is a cool example of kind of a organization that works in a decentralized way, even if it isn't sort of encoded governance. Its governance works in a pretty decentralized way. Do you see that as a potential way to that these ideas can get explored as well?
Absolutely. So there's something called Gitcoin grants, which is a program that the Ethereum Foundation and I believe Vitalik himself personally have helped fund, that is based on quadratic funding and uses that to support open source public good provision within the Ethereum community. So that's a perfect example of one of these ideas being tried out there. But there's also people experimenting with new forms of property, such as this common ownership self-assessed tax or self-assessed licenses sold at auction, cost or salsa models that we were mentioning before. There are people experimenting with new data structures that would allow even more sophisticated things. But it's not just Ethereum. There's other blockchains that are doing it. There's more traditional tech companies that are doing these things. There's data unions of all sorts starting up on a variety of substrates. And that's exactly as it should be, because ultimately what we want is not one system to rule them all, but as I was saying, a bunch of intersecting, overlapping, sort of complex, rich, emergent structures. And that's one of the things I'm proudest of in the radical exchange community is just the diversity of the range in which people are using these ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. Gitcoins is a very cool one. I think that's sort of something that I think is more difficult to do. It's that the taxation is to an extent sort of simpler. It's about like identifying where the inefficiency lies and kind of taxing it. But then the resource allocation, I mean, in your book, you describe kind of this basic income where people would have, you know, effectively stock options in their country. And I know you've since kind of soured on that idea, but I'm curious if you have any interesting ideas of how all this taxation of inefficiencies could eventually be allocated in a way that's more efficient.
Well, so I have sort of turned a little bit away from the notion of universal income, because I think that ultimately the key thing is to collect things that provide collective value, because most of the value in our lives is not individual value. Most of my lifestyle is not from the things that I buy that no one else consumes, but the fact that I live in the New York City area, the fact that I live in a town within the New York City area that provides so many benefits. So if we can fund those collective goods using that revenue, I think it's going to be much more effective than if you just give money to people that they're then going to spend at the stores of a bunch of monopolists who will exploit them, right? So the notion that giving people money directly is giving them directly anything is wrong, because we live in a fundamentally social world where the infrastructure for almost everything we consume is collective within some group of people. And so my money is either going to fund that by giving it to a monopolist who will inefficiently skim something off of that, or by funding in a more efficient way some collective good to be provided to me. And so I'd much rather go directly to the collective goods that people want than basically set up some monopoly that's then, or fund some monopoly that's then going to take advantage of it.
And what would be like the process for that? How do you decide which collective goods, or how do people decide which collective goods to fund?
Well, I think quadratic funding is a really good illustration of the right direction. Again, it's got this very particular formula where it's like the square of the sum of the square roots that people contribute, but it's based on this notion of sort of combining the principle of people expressing how much something matters to them as they do in the market, and the democratic principle of numbers mattering and not just money, right? But there are things maybe beyond that that are even more sophisticated. For example, in quadratic funding, if me and my wife fund something, it receives more funding than if just I fund it. But the reality is, like, me and my wife consume almost all the same things. Like, our lives are together. So it's not really very meaningful to talk about us being these like separate people who are having this public goods problem among them. We'd ideally want a system that incorporates the degree of difference between people, that people who are sort of basically living lives together don't get funded by this, but people who are living lives that are very separate do, right? And that, I think, is the next generation of these types of approaches.
That's really cool. And do you think kind of coercion will always be a part of supplying public goods? Like, someone's always going to have to make someone else do this? Or do you think there are voluntary systems that can emerge where, people contribute, that there's some sort of voluntary taxes that, or organizations like Gitcoin that people kind of contribute to locally and then start to kind of take over some of the role of government?
Well, I kind of disagree with the basic distinction. Because, okay, Look, private property is coercive. In fact, there's very little about private property that is, there's very few institutions that are less coercive in our society than private property. It's one of the most coercive institutions. What it says is basically, if you step onto my property, I can shoot you. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to, right? And on the other hand, if you think about what so-called libertarians say about borders, they would say, oh, it's completely unjustified that any nation should keep anyone out. What a weird set of principles. There's like some property that if you step on it, you can shoot the person. but then you can't do anything to exclude them from the borders of a nation. The reality is that all of these systems are allocations of the limits of what people are and are not allowed to use violence to enforce. And to the extent that these systems become widely legitimate, people forget about the role of violence. That's why it's so easy to say, oh, it's voluntary if if it's based on private property, and it's coercive if it's based on something other than that. It's just because mm-hmm. people are so used to a particular system. And so, yes, I do believe that there are non-coercive methods, but what it means to be non-coercive is that people come to so widely see the legitimacy of this way of organizing things that it's really enforced by community norms and by the way that people choose to live, rather than being enforced by some form of coercion.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a better way of thinking about it. Just we're jumping around a bit, but one of the last topics I'd like to touch on is data monopolies. I know it's something that you've thought about quite a bit. And, with sort of the FANGs, we live in a world where most people, I mean, although they sort of dominate their respective markets, there's kind of, it's difficult to see them as a monopoly because most of their products are free, in the case of sort of Google and Facebook, which isn't the traditional definition of a monopoly that can price above its marginal cost or whatever. And also that their products are good, they make people's lives better. So I guess, could you talk a little bit about the costs of these data monopolies to the world?
Well, the first thing I would highlight is that something being beneficial to people is not inconsistent. In fact, it's almost a necessary condition in order for something to be a monopoly. What a monopoly means is that something has power over people, that they want it, that they need what that thing has, and therefore that the withholding of it can hurt them. So if a company's products is not creating value for people, then it doesn't have monopoly power. In fact, the way you measure monopoly power is like how inelastic the demand is. And the other year, Uber set out to show that it created a lot of value for customers, and it ended up measuring that it had a really inelastic demand, and then it realized, oops, that means that we're a monopolist. So it's in the very the problem of monopoly is not one of failing to create value. The problem of monopoly is the fact that value is not controlled in a way that is democratic, but is instead controlled by a narrow group of people. Anything with increasing returns will create a natural monopoly. And the problem is that if we make that monopoly the private property of someone, we give up the potential value of fully taking advantage of what it's able to create. And data monopolies are a classic example of this. They're a case where the problem is not that the internet isn't great. The internet has huge potential. The problem is not that we don't need search engines. We need search engines. The problem is that turning over what is becoming and should become central to our public square to a bunch of people in t-shirts in Silicon Valley is not so. And it's leading to ridiculous outcomes. It's leading to optimizing for attention in ways that drives genocides. It's leading to a bunch of absurd ways of organizing speech where all of the people who are actually producing quality speech are driven out of the market and can't earn any revenue. And, Wikipedia gets no funding, even though it provides, according to some studies, 40 to 60% of the value of actual queries on Google. And then all the money going to a bunch of people whose job it is to just churn out annoying advertisements. What a waste of resources. What a misallocation. That's the problem, not the internet or the fact that we need some kind of a search engine.
And to what extent do you think kind of crypto can help with this? Because for us, one of the big parts of our, one of the theses why we're involved in the space is the idea that crypto can facilitate almost kind of a new form of human organization, where we had capitalism before and then we had these cooperatives and that crypto is kind of a mix of both, right? And that you have people who provide both capital and work to a network, owning the network and kind of deciding on the future of the network. And so you almost have these kind of digital cooperatives. Do you think that something like that can be the solution to some of these issues?
So I love the idea of digital social innovation. Whether blockchains per se, as opposed to some other form of digital data power structure, are the most desirable, I think is a different question. I think a fundamental problem for me with some conceptions of what's going on in the blockchain space, but there's many others, is that there tends to be, especially Bitcoin maximalists, the notion that, oh, there's going to be this one system like Bitcoin, and it's going to have this very simple set of rules, and that's just going to like make everyone equal, and we don't need to have any other form of organization around that. But the thing is, you know, as I pointed out, any reasonable system is one that actually facilitates the creation of public goods. And those public good creating systems themselves constitute new communities. And those communities then have their issues. So what you actually want to do is facilitate the forming of a diverse range of these types of communities, rather than to be like the one system that then allows just some simple market thing to just work underneath it. And the best systems for doing that are not necessarily a global open ledger to which, you know, completely liberated individuals with their private keys attach, but rather a bunch of intersecting networks, which is the original conception of the internet. The problem is that the internet thought of that in a way that had very, very, very little structure on top of it. And what we've learned is you need more structure. And that's what, you know, these centralized systems have tried to provide. We now need to try to find a way to provide that good in a I don't even know if decentralized is necessarily the right word, but in a way that is consistent with a plurality of different centers of power rather than just these highly concentrated ones.
That makes sense. And I mean, you kind of mentioned it before, but there's also this issue that people bring up that more and more of humanity's resources are allocated to kind of these zero-sum games, whether it's finance or marketing, you know, or defense. These are games that are kind of, I have to invest in it because someone else does. And, you know, there's huge, huge amounts of human capital and financial capital that's devoted to that. So I'm curious if you think that's a problem, and is there a way to solve those kinds of issues as well? You know, it seems like a typical prisoner's dilemma.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think the fundamental principle we always need to keep in mind is that we need to tax congestible things, and we need to use those taxes to subsidize things that are increasing returns. And we don't always know the mechanisms for that.
What do you mean by congestible?
So like, you know, roads get congestible eventually go on them. Land gets congested if too many people are on a piece of land. There's resources that have decreasing returns. The more stuff you pile onto it, the less additional value it is. Tax those things and use those taxes to subsidize things like software and, you know, a lot of the infrastructure for public transit and the infrastructure that creates cities, because those things have increasing returns. The more people that use them, the cheaper they are to provide per person. And, you know, we don't always have the answers on all of these things. Like one example that I think is super important that we haven't, I don't think, figured out quite the right formula for is taxing what I would call cultural capital. The fact that certain of us know how to navigate the SATs to do well on them. Certain of us know how to speak in a way that will make us accepted in broad society. Well, you know, for example, a lot of African Americans speak in a way that's just as deep, just as carries just as much meaning, but is not understood by mainstream society as, you know, easily. And, you know, obviously people with minority languages within a country where there's a dominant majority are in the same situation. So there's all these sort of cultural areas where there's basically a lot of signaling going on that really doesn't have a lot of value. That signaling needs to be taxed in some way. I don't think my cost system is going to directly do that, but we've got to figure out a way to do that, because that's another sort of zero-sum fight for prestige rather than a positive-sum attempt to create things that allow us to share.
That's so interesting. And that's a perfect example of kind of one of the things that I really like about it. It seems like you can think of economics at first principles and kind of think past a lot of the dogma that 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 most of us are taught, I suppose. Are there any tricks that you use to do that, or any sort of or ways that you use to kind of try and get to the core of some of these issues?
Embrace contradictions. You know, a huge problem is that people often, you know, we'll see two areas, let's say like cultural theory and economics, and just compartmentalize them and say, these things are, you know, they're just these weird different ways of talking about stuff. And, you know, I don't know, that's just how it is. What I always try to do when I see two things that contradict each other is to see, is there a way to fully hold these ideas in your mind at the same time and yet make sense of them? And that requires you to, like, you know, sort of do a Rubik's Cube to try to get them to fit together somehow. But when you try to do that, when you don't allow yourself off the hook and just dismiss one perspective as just confused and the other one is absolutely right, but instead try to figure out how they work together, that I think is when you really make intellectual progress.
Awesome. Yeah, that's very cool. And getting to the last few questions here, I'm curious, what kind of work are you doing at Radical Exchange? And is there what's the best way for people to kind of follow what you're doing? Is there anything you want to tell people about that you're working on that you're excited about?
Absolutely. So Radical Exchange is a global social movement with about 100 local groups around the world. They brings together artists, entrepreneurs, activists, political leaders, and academics to try to reimagine the way that our social technology can be formulated. And we are really going on all cylinders there. We're trying to build new knowledge clusters. We're trying to empower entrepreneurs to use these tools to build data unions, video games. We're building art magazines and bringing...
What are you doing in video games, out of curiosity?
Oh, so I mentioned that, you know, Civilization VI, which is the mm-hmm. latest iteration of the most popular strategy game of all time, uses quadratic voting in its diplomatic bargaining protocol. And it uses a bunch of Radical Exchange ideas in defining what, like, the future of governance is going to look like. So that's a really fun example. And, you know, that reaches millions of people, right?
Yeah.
But we are also working with politicians. So Taiwan is using Radical Exchange ideas in a whole variety of ways. And it was very important to the enormous success they had in the COVID response. The state of Colorado is using quadratic finance in funding Main Street businesses, stimulus, but also in making decisions using quadratic voting in its legislature and in its executive decision-making process. And we're working with all sorts of companies in the blockchain space and beyond to build these ideas out. So we really work across all these areas. And I think we've got a real story to tell about how, in addressing the biggest problems we're facing today, whether it's climate change or COVID or regional inequalities or fake news, that Radical Exchange is really there on the cutting edge in the countries that are being most successful, but also in the social networks that are being most successful and doing it that cut across countries. And we need people who want to have that sort of optimistic vision of the future grounded in real successes, work with us to make it a reality.
That sounds really interesting. Do you have anything in London? I assume you do.
London's our most active group in the world. I think we have about 1,500 members in the London group.
Oh, that's awesome. I'll definitely be attending some of those. Okay, last two questions is, what's the book that's most influenced you?
In my whole life?
Yeah. Or the book you most recommend to people if they're, or you know, both if they're different.
Yeah, I mean, I love Henry George's Progress and Poverty is something I would recommend to everyone. It's really amazing. I love Hannah Arendt's On Revolution. That's an amazing book. And I recently read something called The Enigma of Reason, which was really fascinating. It's about sort of how human reason is inherently interactive and social.
That's cool. I'll definitely check those out. And in terms of the favorite piece of media, is there a recent piece of media that sort of sticks out to you, whether it's a podcast or a film or a YouTube video?
Oh, I love Sorry to Bother You by Boots Riley. That's an amazing...
I've never never heard of that either.
It really highlights this idea that I was mentioning before, that like a lot of African-Americans, for example, have really, really profound political and social ideas that are discounted because of the cultural differences between the white world and the African-American world. And that really comes out powerfully in that film, as well as a lot of other fascinating ideas.
That's very cool. I'll put all those in the show notes as well and check them out myself. Well, Glenn, thanks very much for being here. It was a really interesting conversation, and I hope we can do this again.
Yep, take care.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.